I have enjoyed sharing Christ with people and learning the art of evangelism. I have to say, however, I do not have the gift of evangelism. I have had to learn through mistakes. I have had to learn through study and so on. I sometimes go to places, and I once heard a pastor say to me, "Oh, Jerry, we encourage the people with the gift of evangelism to do evangelism at our church." I said, "Oh, I want to speak at your church sometimes so I could tell the people that don't have the gift of giving, they don't have to give anymore. And I don't want to go to the church where only those with the gift of mercy are tender and kind to one another." All of us are to function in all the areas of the gifts. Some people have a special aptitude for it. But Jesus, when he commissioned his disciples to go into all the world, he didn't say, "Only if you have a particular gift." He said, "Everybody should do this." And no matter what your gift is, you have to realize that you are called to exercise that gift in a way that would point people to Jesus. And it's fun. It's not stressful. And we make mistakes. I believe this with all my heart, that we're all relatively awkward. A child learning to walk falls down and gets bruised. A child who has a two-wheel bike with training wheels on it and takes the training wheels off, he falls down and gets abrasions. A child picking up a skateboard and trying to learn how to do that, they will fall down and maybe sprain an ankle or break a wrist. Every new endeavor in life leaves us to some degree of awkwardness. And if you're not awkward in your life somewhere, you're just not growing. And God wants us to use what he has given us to bring others to himself. And don't worry about the awkwardness. Learn and grow like you would in any other area of life if you find some difficulty before you, but you know that this area of life is an important one and a necessary one. I also believe that we do not take Jesus to anybody. He's already there. He's more interested in that person than you and I will ever be. He loves them. He said the fields were white unto harvest. And consequently, because he said the fields are white unto harvest, that means there are people out there who want to know. And if there are people who want to know, he said the real problem is there aren't enough people who want to tell. And we need to cultivate in our hearts a desire to tell other people and to learn the art of it and learn skill in this area, whether we have the gift of evangelism or not. And this idea of God showing up, that he's already there. There's an interesting line from a poet that I got to through my reading of C.S. Lewis. By the way, let me give you a little background on Lewis. I became a Christian in college, and I immediately thought this message of the forgiveness of God that's unconditional and the love of God that is unconditional is too important to be quiet about. So I started sharing Christ with people. I saw the first people that I saw come to Christ within about 3 days, 2 or 3 days after I became a Christian. And I found people were asking me questions. I didn't know the answers to their questions. I was a brand new Christian. But the questions were good questions. If God's good and all powerful, why does evil exist in the world? What about other religions and so on? And I didn't know the answers. But I said to them, "Those are good questions. I'm going to try and find out." No question ends a conversation. Every question is an invitation for you to re-enter the conversation by going and trying to find answers. And when you find the answers, come back and say, "You know that question you asked me the other day? It was an intriguing one, and I've been digging for answers, and this is what I've found. I don't think we ever get to the bottom of these questions, but I think we can find some substantive answers." And so you begin to give them the answers because you say to them, "You matter to me. And your questions matter to me. And this is what I found." Well, as I would do that digging for answers, I kept seeing this name crop up, C.S. Lewis. And I was intrigued, and I ended up reading him. I started studying C.S. Lewis while I was in college. And when I finished college, in America, we call the graduation exercises at a university, they call it commencement, which means you don't get an education in university. You lay a foundation for an education. And commencement means you will now build on that foundation by picking something that will help you stretch. And a man said to me, pick an author who will take you places and keep studying that author so you'll keep growing. I think he could have said, pick a composer, pick an artist, pick a period of history, pick a country. I picked Lewis. I went to seminary and I had to write a thesis. And I wasn't going to write it on the use of the optative mood in the Greek text of Philemon. There's one there, but I wasn't going to write on it. I asked if I could write on Lewis and they said yes. So I started putting pen to paper. As a result, I've been studying him now for 54 years, lecturing on him for 44 years. And I've lectured on him in 81 universities in 21 different countries. And I've found that people connect with Lewis because Lewis talks about these deep longings, the longings that in some senses prompted him and nudged him and goaded him to look for the proper object of the longings. And they led him eventually to Christ. God used them. He was wooing them. And I believe that if the fields are white unto harvest, God is wooing people to himself and nudging them. And in reading Lewis, I came across his references to a poet named Thomas Traherne. And Thomas Traherne was a 1700 pastor in the 1700s in England. And he wrote a book called Centuries of Devotion. And he bundled together 100 devotions and then another 100 and then another 100. They ended up when they were published called Centuries of Devotion. But listen to what he wrote in this one. The noble inclination whereby a man thirsteth after riches and dominion is his highest virtue. There's more to the quote. I want to give it to you, but I read that and I go, what? He's saying that that thing that drives a person to pursue riches and power is the greatest thing about him. I wouldn't have ever said that. But Traherne saw something in the longing for riches and power. And look how he completes the quote. The noble inclination whereby a man thirsteth after riches and dominion is his highest virtue when rightly guided and carries him as in a triumphant chariot to his sovereign happiness. Men are made miserable only by abusing it. Taking a false way to satisfy it, they pursue the wind. Instead of him saying to a person, you shouldn't have the desires that cause you to pursue riches and power, he says, you've got these desires in your pursuit of riches and power. Is it satisfying those desires? Or are those desires ultimately not for riches and power? And you've tethered the desire to the wrong object, and you're still coming up short, hungry, empty, longing for more. And so here is a place where Lewis reminds us there are people out there that we might see are expressing desires, but expressing them in ways that can't ultimately satisfy them, because ultimately what they need is Jesus. Marriage doesn't fulfill. It could be fulfilling, but it doesn't fulfill. Having children is fulfilling, doesn't fulfill. Having a career you like is fulfilling. Ultimately, it doesn't fulfill. Having hobbies and interests can be fulfilling. Ultimately, they don't fulfill. Ultimately, only God fulfills. And St. Augustine captured this as well when he said in the Confessions, thou hast made us for thyself, O Lord, and our hearts are restless till they find their rest in thee. I believe that Augustine observed something that we would be wise to pick up on. People are longing for something, and ultimately it's for God. And if we go out and share Christ with other people, if we could somehow connect with the places where God is already tugging at their hearts, and we can make explicit what he might be doing implicitly, my guess is we're going to get a better hearing for the gospel using what's already there. We don't take Jesus to anybody. He's already there. I remember one time I was coming back from a theology conference in the state of Texas. I'd read a paper at this conference, and I got on the plane to come home, and I was sitting by the window, and a few minutes later, some guy comes and sits in the middle seat, and he says, rats, I've got a middle seat. And if I would have been on my game, I probably would have said, oh, well, why don't you take my seat, and you can have it, and I'll take the middle seat. I didn't do it that day. But nevertheless, he came there, and he was sitting there, and a moment later, a man came and sat on the aisle seat. And he turned and looked at me and he said, Professor Root. I go, you've got the drop on me. I don't think we've ever met. He says, no, but I was at your seminar where you read the paper at the theology meeting. And so this guy, his name was Trevor. Trevor and I start talking back and forth about the theology conference, and we've got the guy on the middle seat. So I turned to the guy on the middle seat and I said, what's your name? He said, Sean. I said, Sean, please forgive us for talking over you. We were both at a theology conference. Please feel free to be part of this conversation. So Trevor and I talked for another couple of minutes. And after we talked, I turned to Sean. I said, Sean, how about you? Are you a spiritual person? He said, I am. I am a spiritual person. I said, well, tell me about that. He said, I saw an advertisement in a paper one time that said I could go and study with a shaman in Peru. And I saved my vacation time and I saved my money. And I went down to Peru and I studied with a shaman. Now, we could hear a story like that and think, oh boy, this is going to be difficult. You know, what's going on with this guy? Don't ever assume that. Assume any leaning into a spiritual hunger might be a place where you can work because God might be working there. And so I said to Sean, after he told me he went and studied with the shaman in Peru, I said, Sean, how did that go for you? And he said, it was the worst money I ever spent in my life. And he was disappointed because he had spiritual hunger and he was looking for the place for it to be fulfilled. And he said to me, how does it work for you, Jerry? And I said, oh, Sean, I am aware of brokenness in my life. I'm aware of incongruities. I'm aware of the fact that I have the high ideal of love, but sometimes I catch myself having sharp words with people I say I love most in the world. I believe in justice, but I found myself at times being unfair in my treatment of other people. And I don't think I could make it in life if, after an honest assessment, I didn't realize that I could be loved unconditionally with the kind of love that God has extended to me in Jesus Christ, and that I could be forgiven of my shortcomings, which give me the opportunity to get back up and grow and learn and get better. And Sean turned to me and said, that's the most comforting thing I've ever heard in my life. I said, Sean, is there any reason why you wouldn't want to trust Christ right now? He said, none. And he prayed with me right there on the plane to trust Christ. Now, Trevor, who was sitting on the aisle, he was working on his PhD at a seminary. He was used to building scaffolding for the gospel, but he wasn't used to obstetrics, actually seeing people born again. And he is just in hog heaven. He's so happy about this. He decided he was going to turn to Sean and encourage him to grow in his new life. Now, Sean lived in a different city than we lived in. We lived in a different city. God put us on the plane for a reason. And we were able to discover where the longings were in his heart. And we were able to speak to them to make explicit what God was doing in his life. Now, Sean went to his city. We got his address. We found out churches in that city. It's nice to know that in this age of social media and computers and so on, you could connect people to other people, other believers who are in those regions and so on. But the point is, God is at work wooing people to himself. He has placed longings in people's heart. And our responsibility, as best we can, is to be sensitive to what God is doing. And we work in that region. Now, Paul, when he wrote Philippians, in chapter 1, verse 12, said, my circumstances have turned out for the greater progress of the gospel. And when he wrote that, he was under house arrest in Rome. It's interesting to me that he saw where he was as a place where God had put him to do his work. I've had people come to me, two different times I had men come to me and they said, oh, Jerry, you got to pray for me. I'm miserable. I'm the only Christian at my place of work, and it is so hard. In both cases, I put my hand on the guy's shoulder, you know, and I said, oh, Lord, please look at my brother here, how miserable he is. Please just take him home to heaven right now. Get him off this earth and get him out of here and take him out of his misery. Both times they knocked my hand off their shoulder. And they said, what are you praying? I said, well, there's two ways you could look at your circumstances. You could say, you're miserable there because you're the only Christian. Or you could say, I am so strategically placed. I'm the only Christian there. Oh God, I can't wait to see what you have for me in this environment. Let me be sensitive to what you're doing. Let me keep my ear to the ground and listen. And let me watch and pray for the people around me that I might be strategically involved in leading people to Christ in this environment. God has placed each of you in strategic places, and we need to do that. We need to be aware of what's going on. We need to pray, and we need to watch where God is already working. He has not sent you to those places and then abandoned you. No, he has sent you to those places, and he wants to use you there and to multiply other believers who could participate with you. Paul ends his epistle to the Philippians. After he's told them he was strategically placed, he ends it by saying, not only have my circumstances worked out for the greater progress of the gospel, at the end of Philippians, he says, the saints in Caesar's household greet you. How was it that he had his pulse on the finger of what was going on in the Roman Empire, and he had it from within a jail cell or a house arrest in Rome? And I think it was because he was sensitive to what God was doing in the place where he put him strategically. We know that he was chained to a Praetorian Guard. They were the crack military unit in the Roman Empire. And I could see him every time when those soldiers would come to switch out their responsibilities to watch over Paul. He had a captive audience. I could see him turning to the guards and start talking to them about faith, talking to them about their life and finding out where God was already working in their life, sharing the gospel with them. The Praetorian Guard goes back to the office. He sees the assignments on the list. And one guy says, I've got this Paul assignment. I don't know what that is today. The other guy said, I had it last week. If you don't want to go, I'll switch out assignments to you. I had a great conversation with him. I think my life is changing. Paul did not see limits. He saw God working. And we need to see God working in whatever circumstance we're in. There's a really interesting passage in a book that Dante wrote. Dante, the author of the Divine Comedy, it's called The Demonarchia. And he says, function precedes essence. Function precedes essence. God had a purpose before he gave the essences to fulfill the purpose. If you look at the creation account, he makes light the purpose on day one. He doesn't make the sun, moon, and stars, the essences, to fulfill the purpose and emit light till day four. God had a purpose for you. There was never a new understanding of that purpose. In the mind of omniscience, the omniscient God always knew he was going to make you, always knew he was going to assign you to a place and time in this universe. And he gave you, in the essence he gave you, exactly what you needed for that assignment. And it's really fun to think that he has equipped you fully and made you ready to go. I remember years ago, I would go to lunch I would meet with different people in the area of my work. I needed to have these working lunches. And I went to this one restaurant 4 days a week. The guy who ran the restaurant, his name was Brad. And when I would go there and I would see Brad, I would always have small talk with him so we could cultivate a relationship. And a pastor, when I was a new Christian, said, if God answered every prayer you prayed this last week, would there be anybody new in the kingdom? If I'm not praying for people to come to Christ, then I'm probably not seeing where God is already pulling and nudging at people's hearts. I'm not seeing where the longings are emerging and manifesting themselves so I could speak to those things. So as I got to know Brad, I started praying for him every day. I saw him every day, small talk. Hey, Brad, I like the menu today. I like the sandwich. Hey, Brad, did you catch the game on the sports event on TV last night? Hey, Brad. We'd have small talk every day. And then finally, I came to the place where I told him, Brad, I pray for you every day. I've never said that to a person and had them say to me, would you stop it? It went like that, where every day I then had small talk, but only once every 3 weeks I would tell him I was praying for him. 9 months passed I saw a couple of other people at that restaurant come to faith. One of the waitresses came to faith and so on. But no real progress with Brad, but letting him know I was praying for him. The day came when all of a sudden he came to me and he said, "Jerry, I need to talk with you." We went down the street to a coffee shop and we talked for 3 hours as he told me how his life was unraveling. Why is he telling me? The deepest we ever got was, "I'm praying for you." But he's letting me know where the crisis in his life is revealing felt need. After 3 hours, I shared with him the gospel in a few minutes, and he said, "I don't want to give, I need this gospel, but I don't want to give God my life like it is now. It's falling apart. I'll wait till I fix it first, then I'll give it to him." I said, "Well, Brad, it's not usually done that way. You try it, however, and if it doesn't work, let me know." And I went back to just telling him every 3 weeks I was praying for him. 5 months later, he called me and he said, "Jerry, my way's not working. Can I come to your office and talk with you?" And Brad gave his heart to Jesus at that office after all those months. But it was while working with the felt need where he saw that his life was unraveling and he couldn't put it together himself. It's great. It's great. We want to watch for the felt need and then work where God is already working, making explicit what he's doing implicitly.